From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. At least 17 people have lost their lives to the wildfires in Northern California. The blazes have left at least 180 people injured and destroyed thousands of homes and businesses. The series of fires that flared up north of San Francisco on Sunday night are among the deadliest in California history. Fire officials have not yet determined the cause of any of the fires. One of the worst hit places is the city of Santa Rosa. Leslie McClurg from KQED reports.
Windows crack and walls crumble as flames engulf a strip of homes in the neighborhood of Fountain Grove. Shreds of three flags are burning in the front of the Hilton Hotel. The structure is ashes. An orange sun peeks eerily through a dark gray sky over a blackened lawn. Across the street, smoke billows from a mobile home park for seniors on fixed incomes. Homeowners stroll slowly through debris.
This was my home.
Charlene Gilman's hands shake as she wipes tears from her eyes. Gilman inherited her yellow mobile home from her mother 7 years ago.
You feel so hopeless.
She looks up and down her streets at the smoldering lots.
And then Kat and Dave and Mitch.
Across the street, a swimming pool is a black puddle surrounded by torched deck furniture. Like many residents in Santa Rosa, Gilman received a knock on the door in the middle of the night demanding she evacuate immediately.
You know, it's like your brain just goes dead. It's like, okay, what do I take? What do I take? And I got a few clothes, but that's about it.
One block away, a neighbor counts his blessings. Kenneth Seamus stares kind of wild-eyed at his brown mobile home.
I'm looking at my home still intact. It was scary last night when I left here.
What did it look like?
Like an inferno. Things were popping and banging, and this house right here was just engulfed.
Other than a layer of ashes on his front porch railing, Seamus's home looks perfectly normal. Fortunately, downtown Santa Rosa was not damaged by the flames either, but all businesses are closed. There wasn't a soul walking along the streets when I drove through. But a shelter at the fairgrounds was packed with people nervously making calls, trying to find out more information about the homes they fled. Bonnie Shelley lost power in the middle of the night.
No TV, no radio, no Wi-Fi, no anything. So we couldn't get any message to evacuate, so we just kind of evacuated ourselves.
Shelley says the hills surrounding her home were red in every direction.
The winds last night were unbelievable. I've been here 10 years. I've never experienced anything like that. And no wonder the fires are all over the place.
She wasn't even able to get her car because her garage door wouldn't open with the power out. Shelley hitched a ride with a friend to the shelter. She's still waiting to hear whether her home is okay.
I brought this blanket that I'm sitting on. Thank God.
Otherwise, she just has her purse. But she feels lucky to have a roof over her head.
We're safe. It's warm. We have food. We have medical stuff if we need it. So apparently more than just me left with nothing.
Without a charger for her phone, Shelley is depending on officials at the shelter to tell her what's next. For Here and Now, I'm Leslie McClurg in Santa Rosa.
Well, let's take up now the virulent staph infection MRSA, which you probably know affects hospital patients, but for the last 20 years or so has also affected athletes, some of whom have died, as a recent New York Times story reminds us. And sports programs are taking incredibly aggressive steps to prevent more deaths. Colgate University bought a machine that uses ozone gas to disinfect gear after a hockey player came down with MRSA. Dr. Deverick Anderson is director of the Duke Infection Control Outreach Network, which works with the NFL on anti-MRSA efforts. He joins us from the Duke University studios in Durham. Dr. Anderson, remind us first what MRSA is and why it is such a problem.
MRSA stands for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. It's a germ that can often live on skin. It's one of the leading causes of infections that we see when people or patients come into the hospital and experience healthcare of some sort. It can cause skin infections, surgical infections, and even very serious blood infections that can lead to death. One of the, as you mentioned, one of the interesting things in the last couple of decades is we've noticed it migrating outside of the hospital and seeing it in patients that we really hadn't seen it in before. People that have not been in the hospital and are not receiving frequent health care. And I think athletes are a really good example of that. These are very healthy people overall, and yet these are a group of people that are now at increased risk for skin infections in particular from MRSA.
Well, we have a colleague who's a runner who fell, and the next thing you knew, his knee was all blown up. MRSA had gotten into that wound. I know of a tennis player who picked it up in a locker room, and the next thing he knows, they're aggressively trying to cut away hip skin as it is spreading. So people probably are aware of this anecdotally. But how big an issue is it? I mean, the NFL has a 300-page manual on MRSA prevention. Is it that widespread?
Well, we wrote that manual. That is a manual that actually includes information about all types of infection prevention, but it does have a lot of information about MRSA. These are infections that can really cause harm, end careers, and again, as you see in the news, can put people in the hospital and for some time. In the big picture, there are lots of skin infections that happen out there. Most of them are small, you receive antibiotics, you go home, and everything is fine. It's just those really serious and devastating ones that we read about. And so we have this perception that it's extraordinarily common.
Well, we mentioned Colgate. The school buys many sets of equipment for the athletes, so one set can always be sanitized. There's a plan for a system that would basically coat locker rooms with a decontaminating fog of hydrogen peroxide and silver, which prevents the spread. Professional athletes, you have found, football players are 7 to 10 times more likely than the general public to have MRSA on their skin, the bacteria on their skin. So again, when they come in contact with others. And what's fascinating is that we're hearing that there are some trends with younger athletes that could be a big problem in the future. They don't like to shower. Younger athletes, high school athletes, don't like to get in the shower with other athletes. And there's also body shaving, which can cause nicks. Talk about those concerns.
Those are, I think, very serious concerns because in the broad scheme of things that we can try and do to prevent these infections from happening, knowing that these are players or patients that are at increased risk, the key is really, really back to the basics. And so hygiene is absolutely the mantra that we preach. It is scattered throughout the manual that we provided to the NFL. You're going to have some exposure. You're going to have skin abrasions. You're going to have skin-to-skin contact because of what you do as an athlete. So you are not going to be able to reduce that risk to zero. But what can we do to reduce it to the greatest extent possible so that it's as close to zero? It's hygiene. It's showering after practice. It's washing our hands regularly. We believe that if you put those practices into effect, then you are going to be effective at reducing your risk. So this trend of not wanting to shower, and again, I've even heard anecdotes about this at other levels in colleges and in professional teams as well. I think it seems to be increasingly common throughout the ranks. That's, I think, important and concerning because that, to me, is probably the key ingredient we have in when we're trying to decrease the risk of MRSA.
Well, the Times quotes an athletic director at Palo Verde High in Tucson saying, I don't know, maybe young athletes don't want the hazing that can go along with those group showers. But it started about 10, 15 years ago. And they also quote a player who's now at Colgate in college. And he says, boy, when I was in high school, we thought it was weird to shower after practice. Now it's weird if you don't. So thankfully, they've changed. But somehow that has become pervasive.
Yes, it has. And I don't know that I have a very good explanation for why that's the case. Perhaps we do need to do a better job of messaging about the importance of hygiene at all levels, but in particular in post-practice after this high-risk period, maybe we need to do a better job of getting that message out.
Maybe we've all just become grungier. I'm being serious, you know, and we don't think about that. Dr. Devrick Anderson, director of the Duke Infection Control Outreach Network. He works with the NFL to prevent the spread of MRSA, this virulent staph infection. Dr. Anderson, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, before we go to break, a moment from last night's BET Hip Hop Awards. Rapper Eminem lashed out at President Trump in a 5-minute freestyle rap, accusing the president of disrespect for veterans, hypocrisy, and racism.
It's like we take a step forwards, then backwards. But this is his form of distraction. Plus, he gets an enormous reaction when he attacks the NFL, so we focus on that instead of talking Puerto Rico with gun reform for Nevada, all these horrible tragedies, and he's bored and would rather cause a Twitter storm with the Packers than says he wants to lower our taxes. Then who's gonna pay for his extravagant trips back and forth with his family to his golf resorts and his mansions from his endorsement of Bannon, support for the Klansmen, tiki torches in hand for the soldier that's black and comes home from Iraq and is still told to go back to Africa, forking a dagger in this racist 94-year-old grandpa who keeps ignoring our past historical deplorable factors.
Now if you're a black rapper Eminem athlete, last night at the BET Awards. We'll link you to more at hereandnow.org. To try to give those a voice who don't have one. Today is National Coming Out Day, a day of awareness for the LGBT community. It's something that didn't exist when longtime gay rights advocate Cleve Jones came out. Jones worked with San Francisco politician Harvey Milk before Milk was assassinated. He also came up with the idea for the AIDS quilt. Last year, Jones published the memoir When We Rise. It is now out in paperback. I spoke with Cleve Jones when the book was first published. And what an amazing journey you've had, as you tell in this book.
And I'm still standing.
You're still standing. And let's go back to the very beginning, because you were growing up in the 50s and 60s in Arizona as a gay person. It was not easy. It was not something that was widely shared at the time. And you thought about suicide for a while and then decided not to go through with it. Why? What stopped you?
Well, life back then was, you know, very different, and there was almost no information about any kind of sexuality, let alone homosexuality. But I was getting tormented a lot at school, and so when I finally understood that what this word meant, I went and looked it up in my father's library. My father was a psychologist, and, you know, quickly learned that what I was deemed mentally ill and also a criminal offense. So I was very frightened, and I think I'm of that last generation of gay people who grew up not really knowing that if there were other people like us at all. And then one afternoon, hiding out in the school library, avoiding the bullies, I happened on the 1971 Year in Review issue of Life magazine, and it had a big story about gay liberation called Homosexuals in Revolt. And that was when I first learned that not only were there lots of people like me, but there was a community and a movement, and there were photographs of all these attractive young men with long hair with their fists in the air fighting the police. And I thought, wow, I got to get out of Phoenix.
And you did. And you went to where there were more people like you.
Yeah, I hitchhiked up to San Francisco.
So how did you meet Harvey Milk?
You know, that's probably the question I am asked most frequently, and I don't remember. Harvey was a character in the neighborhood, and I definitely knew him before I went traveling in Europe and the Middle East and kept in touch. And when I got back in 77, that was when our friendship really deepened as we began to get ready to fight the Briggs Initiative, Prop 6, which would have banned gay people from working in any school district in the state. And Harvey was very much a mentor to me. He was a bit of a father figure since I was still estranged from my real father at that time. And he was one of our leaders and a very inspiring guy. He was also extremely funny, and I enjoyed his company very much and was proud that he saw value in me.
Harvey Milk, of course, was assassinated along with the mayor of San Francisco, and you came upon his body in City Hall. I just want to have you read something for us that you wrote for the one-year anniversary of the assassination of Harvey Milk. It's on page 185, if you could read this. This was a speech that you gave to people in the streets in San Francisco who had gathered.
This speech was actually given on the steps of San Francisco City Hall, overlooking Civic Center Plaza, and this is the last third of the speech. I wonder how many of you here tonight have lost a friend or loved one to suicide. Raise your candles high. How many? I wonder how many of you know a woman who has experienced the pain and terror of rape, Let me see your candles. How many? How many of you have been attacked? How many of you have been beaten? By bashers or the police? How many? How many of you have heard the taunting cry from behind? Hey, faggot. Hey, dyke. How many? That is why we are here tonight. That is why we marched on Washington. That is why we will keep on marching. That is why Harvey lived. That is why Harvey died. That is why we will not rest until Harvey's dream is fulfilled, when lesbians and gay men of every age, race, and background come out to join in the struggle with all of us who seek lives of freedom and dignity and joy. It will be a long struggle. There will be decades of campaigns and leaders and no doubt many martyrs. But let no one misunderstand. Our movement is powered by the determination of a people too long denied, too long abused, a people who seek only the freedom to live, to work, and to love. Let no one misunderstand. We are deadly serious. We grow daily in power, and we will not be stopped. That is why we are here tonight.
As you read that, does it take you back to the time you read it for the first time?
Well, it certainly takes me back to that night, but it also seems to me to be something of a foreshadowing of what was to come, the reference to martyrs. When I wrote those words, I was just assuming that there would be other leaders who would be assassinated, as Harvey was, possibly even myself. But of course, I didn't know that the virus we now call HIV was already in my own bloodstream that night and in the bodies of so many of the people who were standing in Civic Center Plaza, most of whom did not survive.
Well, and in fact, you yourself came very close to not surviving. How did it happen that you turned the corner like that and got better, and you're here to talk to us today?
Well, really, I begin the book by saying that the movement saved my life, and that's not hyperbole. I was ready to kill myself when I was 15, and I read about gay liberation in Life magazine, and I flushed those pills down the toilet. And I came very close to dying, but thanks to the efforts of ACT UP and Project Inform and great heroes like Larry Kramer and Martin Delaney, I was able to access medications. I don't think I would have lived another 6 months if I hadn't gotten into that first clinical trial. So that's the point of this book, is to show that the movement saves people's lives.
Do you think that the marches and rallies and speeches are still a big part of the movement, or should be a big part of the movement? Is people like you putting to words what, you know, you feel need to be said in order to take the movement to the next level?
Well, that's a very good question, and I suppose I have a different answer for that than I would have had before this most recent election. I believe that everything we have achieved could be swept away in the blink of an eye. So this is not a time for complacency or self-congratulations. We've achieved some remarkable progress, but we need to understand that none of this is permanent. And, you know, history just gives us too many examples of people who thought they were free and woke up one morning and discovered that they were not, and discovered soon after that they were going to have to fight or die. I believe that the movement is more necessary now than ever.
And it doesn't seem like you have very much faith in the younger generation of gays and lesbians to do the kind of work that you and your peers did.
Oh, no, to the contrary. I think that young people today, the millennials, the young people coming up, regardless of their sexual orientation or gender identity, I think are facing a lot of challenges, and I have great empathy for that and concern for them. I worry that those who have grown up under the Obama years don't really understand how strong they're going to have to be. I believe that this election is a catastrophe, not only for LGBT people, but for the country and for the world. I do not think I will live long enough to see the damage undone. And I think that young people today need to prepare themselves for the possibility of having to cope with this and struggle against this for the rest of their lives.
How important do you think the AIDS quilt is now, so many years after you came up with the idea for it?
Well, to be honest, I think the AIDS quilt has been largely forgotten. It's been living in a warehouse in Atlanta for a long time and is rarely seen because the death rate has gone down so dramatically. And so I'm grateful for that, that the need for the quilting bees that were going on all over the country and around the world, that has diminished. But it concerns me because of this trait we have in this country of not knowing our own history. And the quilt was there at a particular moment in time when it was necessary, and it certainly did its work. I feel quite confident when I say that that quilt played a very important role in reducing the stigma associated with AIDS.
What was it like for you to go back over your entire life like this? And you talk at one point about dumping a box of photographs out. I wonder if that helped you even write this book because you could remember what happened at certain moments. But what was it like to go back over your life and relive all of these moments?
Well, that really began in 2008, working with Dustin Lance Black and Gus Van Sant on the film Milk. Dustin Lance Black came to visit me. I was living in Palm Springs at the time, where I'd gone to sort of retreat and retire and try to regroup. But I'd been sick for a very long time, and I was exhausted. And I was also, honestly, very depressed because almost everybody I loved the most had died, and I missed them. And so Dustin Lance Black and Gus Van Sant required me to go through those boxes of old photographs and tell those stories. And then the film came out, and suddenly all these young people wanted to hear from me. It was like being exhumed. And I decided then that I needed to go back to San Francisco, that I apparently was not going to die soon, and that if I had more time left, I should use it, and I should go back to the place where I most belong and the place I love the most. So it was a process of getting, you know, re-engaged with the movement and, most importantly, getting back to my roots. And my roots are on Castro Street in San Francisco, California.
Cleve Jones, whose new memoir is called When We Rise, My Life in the Movement, a great read. And thank you so much for joining us once again, Cleve Jones.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And we spoke last December. When We Rise is now out in paperback.
Here in Boston, fans expect a lot from their teams and a lot from the reporters who cover them. I'm Boston Globe sports columnist Chris Gasper. I'm working with WBUR to bring you a new daily podcast, Season Ticket. I'll take fans with me for a behind-the-scenes look from the press box to the locker room and beyond. Season Ticket, available at wbur.org/seasonticket or wherever you get your podcast. Funding provided by Zip, the smartest way to hire.
3 weeks after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, 40% of the island still lacks running water. Ryan Mann Hamilton joins us now. He's volunteering on the west coast of Puerto Rico. And Ryan, you're trying to get bottled water and filtration systems to people who still don't have running water. Is the water situation getting any better?
No, unfortunately it is not. What we've had is actually an increase in waterborne diseases, because folks are using water from different unpurified sources and such. Right now, it's actually easier to find a can of beer or a Coke can than it is a little bottle of water in any of the stores here.
And what is the reason for that at this point? We were hearing earlier on that, you know, supplies were arriving in Puerto Rico, but they couldn't get out to different parts of the island because there weren't the truckers to do that. What's the reason at this point?
Well, that's a great question. I was actually at the port yesterday. We received 20 pallets of water and 5 pallets of food and other supplies. And we were not actually able to take it out of the port for bureaucratic reasons. They have to go through customs, and they have to do this and a lot of different paperwork. So we hope that arrives today. Today we'll be picking up water as well that's being flown in to Ponce through the airport. So hopefully that shouldn't be an issue. I think the problem actually has been the bureaucracy. You can literally go to San Juan, and the ports are full of tankers, just full of tankers. Really, things are just not getting out. And if they are getting out, they're staying in specific places. So, for example, we are on the west coast of the island, which from San Juan, the largest port, is probably the furthest point. And so we have seen very little of that. Now we see some of National Guard trucks distributing water, but FEMA is nowhere to be seen in these parts of the island itself. And so it's a huge issue right now. What we've been doing is deploying portable water filtration systems to different communities and just filtering water for them and then handing out as many filters as possible as we have so that people can filter their own water, at least for their basic needs.
But what is the water that they're filtering? Where are they getting that water?
From rivers, from streams, from these natural water holes, basically little springs, natural springs that spring up from different mountain sites. So for folks in the mountains, at least, it's easier to get a freshwater source. For folks who are on the coastline, that's a very difficult task. There's discrepancies in terms of region and geography as well.
So if there were a FEMA official listening to this, what would you say that you need right now?
I say we need supplies, for one, but I think they should just leave it in the hands of, to be honest, the local municipal government and other volunteers. FEMA has shown that they are not at all responsive and really just are more prone to follow sort of rules and directions instead of being flexible. And I think this is a moment where things need to be flexible. You can't just go by the rules because, well, you know, this is an unprecedented moment. And so right now, for example, if you go around here, you can find communities that will still say 2 weeks into it that not a single person from any government entity has gone to those communities to ask or to verify how those people are.
And aside from water, what other supplies are people still in need of in Puerto Rico?
Besides the water issue, of course, there are issues with food. Right now, if you go to any type of supermarket or whichever, or there will be a line. You are not allowed to buy certain things in excess. For example, you're only limited to certain amounts. If you go to the bank, there are still lines. You're only limited to a certain amount of money that you can take out, which creates problems because then everyone has to go back every day to take out money. I mean, so what we see is across the board, the services are just are horrible at this point in time.
That's Ryan Mann Hamilton, who is part of a coalition of volunteers trying to deliver clean water to people in Puerto Rico. Ryan, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
So what happens when you're a 12-year-old Iron Age wizard with no magic and you go out into the dark woods with your wildcats and sprites, squeeze Jews and bumbleboozles among them, to catch a witch to steal her magic? But instead, in your witch trap, you find a flyaway-haired, eye-patch-sporting 13-year-old warrior girl who doesn't even know she has magic, such a girl thing. But suddenly, you're both chased by a very stinky, hovering presence. Well, that's what happens in The Wizards of Once, the latest young adult novel from Cressida Cowell, who also wrote the hugely successful How to Train Your Dragon series, 7 million books sold and a movie franchise. This new adventure is every bit as charming, in addition to magic adventure, disdainful adults, and clever but flawed children. It offers more than a few lessons about stereotyping, inclusion, and who knew, the virtues of giants. Cressida Cowell joins us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm just thrilled to have the book coming out in the U.S.
Well, you know, what I want to say to you is how lucky are you that you live in this world.
It's just a wonderful job to have. I feel so privileged.
Well, let's explain to people. And by the way, it's delightful to just read as an adult. It's sort of an Iron Age Romeo and Juliet, except the protagonists are really goofy. They don't fall in love. They're sworn enemies, the warrior and the wizard.
It's a world split in two. It's set in the Iron Age, 3,000 years ago, a world in which magic really exists. It's wild woods, giants, sprites, and the two protagonists are from tribes that are at war. So this is a community that is split in half. The warriors and wizards are fighting each other to the death.
What are you saying overall about, you know, here's this young warrior boy, Czar, who he doesn't have the magic, and talk about feeling a little impotent, as you know, a preteen. This girl who, you know, she's got an eye patch and this static electricity hair. She's got magic that she's hiding. What are you saying about young people?
This isn't just about young people. I suppose the core message is about empathy. On a screen, things happen out there. Mm-hmm. And in a book, they're happening inside your head. You are that person. So this book is very much about empathy and trying to provoke empathy. You know, mm-hmm. the two protagonists have to try and see things from each other's point of view.
Right. And what about the tone? Is it just hilarious? Czar is surprised at one point that Wish, the warrior girl, might be a person of destiny. His mentor, Czar's mentor, a raven, Caliburn, says, really, Czar, do you think this is the Dark Ages? Meaning, you know, why can't a girl be a person of destiny? And then the next sentence, the narrator, this is crazy narrator, it's kind of this borscht belt comic who's along for the ride, says, well, actually, it was the Dark Ages, but nobody ever in the Dark Ages ever thinks they're living in the Dark Ages. What about that tone?
It's a complicated tone because I want my books to work on a number of different levels. So I want them to be very grabby, make children want to read them. I always think that books should be like sweets, not Brussels sprouts. You know, they make you laugh, they maybe make you cry, or they make you think. And so I have a real mixture of things going on in the books all the time. It makes it complicated with the pacing and the rhythm of it. But I think you should never dumb down to children. I have confidence in the intelligence of children.
Well, it feels too like it will make them roll a lot of words around on their tongue. I mean, the use of words is just so much fun. For instance, here's an illustration. We'll talk about the illustrations in a second, but here's a big black feather. And you've written out, you know, human handwriting. Could this really be the feather of a witch? The witch feather? I mean, just saying that is fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I pay a lot of attention to the mouthfeel of the word. So it begins, once there was magic. It was a long, long time ago in a British isle so old it did not know it was the British Isles yet. And the magic lived in the dark forests. And just the sound of that, I mean, often in my sheds, you know, saying that aloud as I'm writing, because I'm imagining it being read aloud by an adult to a kid. I think books read to you in your parents' voice or your teacher's voice live with you all your life. And that's why I try and make the books very moving. You know, that sends a message. You know, books can make my dad cry. You know, it can make my mum laugh. And books are about language. You know, a kid who reads is a kid who thinks.
Well, here's one of the signs that's posted on the entrance to the woods. You have now entered the Iron Warrior Empire. All magic is banned in this territory. No sprites, no giants, no rogue breaths, no snow cats, no werewolves, no green teeths, or any other magic creatures. No flying, no enchanted objects, no spelling, cursing, or charming, no magic whatsoever. And any wizards entering these lands may most unfortunately have their heads removed.
Stern message from Wish's mother, Queen Sycorax, who's a strong woman.
Right.
Yeah, she's the queen of the warriors.
And does not like magic, which her daughter has and is hiding. Look, the illustrations, just fantastic. You studied art. It's as if, you know, Peter Pan and Tinkerbell, because there's all these sprites, were drawn by Edward Gorey, you know, the scary illustrator. Hans Christian Andersen were goth.
I did a lot of looking at traditional ideas of fairies and sprites and Arthur Rackham, who illustrated Peter Pan. And in the same way, I looked at a lot of traditional texts about magic. So Arthur, the Sword and the Stone, Wizard of Earthsea, Book of Three. But I also want to make things feel relevant and modern for children. So I look at sort of things like punk in the illustrations. And there's a British fashion designer called Alexander McQueen who uses punk and insects in his designs. And I try and get that sort of modern kind of reinventing a classic kind of feel into the illustration to overturn the idea in the kid's mind that books are something schooly, they're something old-fashioned, while at the same time not dumbing down. So it's a complicated process that I'm going through. The other thing that books are very good at igniting in a kid is creativity, because books don't tell you everything. So presenting them with problems, you know, that need to be solved in the books and not necessarily giving them the answers, but also in the illustrations, presenting them with a magic that they maybe haven't seen before. That then ignites, hopefully, their own creativity. I love it when kids send me in pictures of their own dragons, you know, because of the How to Train Your Dragon series. But also, I'm hoping they're going to send me pictures of their own imaginations of magic.
Right.
And at the end of the book, there's a moment when Caliburn, the talking raven, gives Wish a feather and said, "This is one of my feathers in the spelling book. Go take this feather, write your own story." And I'm hoping that kids are gonna read the book and be inspired to make up their own story, make up their own magic.
Well, and by the way, the end of the book doesn't answer a lot of questions. It leaves a lot unanswered. You know, not everybody is what they seem. Not everything is the happy ending that it seems. I mean, we just don't want to give it away. It seems as if this is going to be a new series.
Yeah, it is the beginning to a new series.
Can't wait. Cannot wait.
Oh, thank you
now,
so
listen,
much.
Now, listen, I just want to take a second to ask about you, because according to Wikipedia, your father is Michael Hare, 2nd Viscount Blankenham,
And
your uncle by marriage, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer.
Yes,
What? You grew up both in London and on a small uninhabited island off the west coast of Scotland.
Yeah.
Is that where this all kind of came, you know, growing up a child on an uninhabited island?
I have to say, my dad was a businessman, so I grew up in London in a house without a garden. But he's also an environmentalist, and so his heart was in the wilderness. Every year from when I was a baby, we would be taken by a local boatman to an island off the west coast of Scotland. And we'd be dropped off by the boatman and picked up again 2 weeks later. Absolutely no way of contacting the outside world if something went wrong. By the time I was nine, my dad had a house built on the island so we could spend the whole summer there. And that was where the Vikings first came to, that part of Scotland, when they invaded Great Britain, and it was the last place they left. And the Isle of Burke is that island, you know, in How to Train Your Dragon.
Huh.
So extraordinary childhood, which totally ignited my imagination.
That's Cressida Cowell, author of the new young adult fantasy adventure, The Wizards of Once. And of course, she's the creator of the popular How to Train Your Dragon series. Cressida, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
The controversy over NFL players protesting during the national anthem continues. President Trump tweeted today, "It's about time that Roger Goodell of the NFL is finally demanding that all players stand for the national anthem." The president's tweet follows a letter the NFL commissioner sent to the 32 team owners yesterday. In that letter, Goodell wrote, "Like many of our fans, we believe that everyone should stand for the national anthem." He also wrote that the NFL cares deeply about players and respect their opinions and concerns about critical social issues. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, it seems like the president is claiming victory there, but if you read the letter, Goodell isn't really demanding that NFL players stand for the anthem.
No, the verb was demand, and Goodell said he'd like it, which is not quite demand. And in fact, since demand's an absolute, I would say it's just flat out not demand. This comes on the heels of President Trump tweeting that the NFL should lose its status as a nonprofit entity. Guess what? They gave that up in 2015.
Right.
And the president also claiming that NFL ratings are down, way down. In aggregate, they may be down in the low single digits. That Dallas Cowboys-Packers game did gangbuster ratings, as Packers often do. And I think with the ratings question, 78 shows are on network TV, and 77 of them had ratings that were down or flat from last year because of the times we live in. So this is all just prologue to say that oftentimes when the president makes an assertion, especially around this issue, it's not accurate.
But what is Goodell saying then?
I don't know. I think he's saying this. I think he's saying that we would like this issue to go away. And he's also acknowledging Goodell is a vessel for 32 owners and what they want to do. He has to sense what they want to do, and he has to deliver for them the strategy that will maximize profit. Right. And he senses this is not a good issue for him. How could it be a good issue for him? So perhaps he's eliciting them, trying to gain their input and find out ways that we could make the national anthem controversy go away. And maybe one of those ways is a platform or some sort of negotiation with the leaders. It's not exactly a formal movement, but maybe you get a guy like Malcolm Jenkins or Michael Bennett or some of the other more vocal players who gave him a 10-page memorandum of what they want. And I guess maybe buy them off by meeting their demands, he's thinking. I don't know if that will work. I think that the anthem protest is, for them, working. For the players who want to raise the issue and perhaps make even some NFL fans uncomfortable, this is exactly what they want.
What about the Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones, who had threatened to bench players who, quote, disrespect the flag? Here's Jones on his radio show this week on KRLD-FM in Dallas.
I don't want there to be any misunderstanding as to where I want the personnel of the Cowboys to be when we're at the number one workplace we have, which is the field and the sideline on game day.
Now, Jerry Jones had stood arm in arm with his Cowboys players and even took a knee with them before the anthem. What's going on here?
Right. He took a knee with them before the anthem. I don't know exactly what that means. Unity. He stood arm in arm with them during the anthem. Unity. No Cowboy player has taken a knee during the anthem. So he's saying if a Cowboy player does something that they haven't done before, we'll do something we haven't done before. I think it's a ploy or a tactic. He's a showman and he's a businessman to assure Cowboys fans that this isn't going on. The NFL labor union and also the NAACP is taking issue with this stance. But if no Cowboy player wants to take an E, I think it will just be a lot of hot air about nothing.
All right. I want to ask you about one other thing that is somewhat related to all of this that we've been talking about. ESPN has suspended host Jemele Hill for 2 weeks after she used social media to comment on what Jerry Jones said. She tweeted, "Jerry Jones also has created a problem for his players, specifically the black ones. If they don't kneel, some will see them as sellouts. Just so we're clear, I'm not advocating an NFL boycott, but an unfair burden has been put on players." Earlier on Twitter, Hill had called President Trump a white supremacist. But how does what's going on with Jemele Hill fit into all of this?
Well, first of all, President Trump is looking at it and saying, claiming victory again. Second of all, after the first white supremacist tweet, she was warned and talked to by ESPN. I don't know the exact nature of them putting out red lines. This is what you can say. This is what you can't say. But it does seem at least that she was on a sort of probation, like stay away from third rail topics like this. And she did not. Is it fair that they told her to stay away from third rail topics? Looked at one way, she is the host of their 6 p.m. sports center. So she is a journalist, but she was hired to be an opinion journalist. She got that gig because of how she waded into opinion. It's a hard situation. And I have some sympathy for Jemele Hill because obviously, her whole brand is talking about real issues in the news, inflected with opinion and her take on things. She gets hired and rewarded for doing that, and then she gets suspended when she weighs into the very area that she made her name on, that ESPN said, you know, we need you to be, we need you to inhabit this role for our network. Right.
We talked to her when her show first launched, and that's exactly what she said is, you know, you can't separate news from sports anymore, and we're going to talk about things that are going on. So we will yeah. see what happens now. Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.